This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
And the only reason that I am not in prison, that Penny Hess is not in prison, that Jesse Neville is not in prison, that we didn't have to pay those fines, the only reason is because we fought.
The Biden administration fails to win imprisonment of the Uhuru 3.
For every 8 executions that are carried out in the United States, one person is found innocent. And that's just not a good batting average.
Gloria Rubeck of the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement shares a report.
They assert that the people who advocate for equality and fairness in society are unhumans and need to be crushed.
Historian Russ Ballant discusses the Project 2025 agenda to privatize public services, education, and healthcare, alongside crackdowns on immigrants and leftist movements.
They didn't care where this stuff went, and they didn't want to know, frankly. They just said, sell the cocaine, give us the money.
December 10th marked the 20th anniversary of the suspicious death of investigative journalist Gary Webb, who uncovered and extensively documented the U.S. government's role in fueling the crack cocaine epidemic of the 1980s and 1990s. This week, we'll air part 2 of a 2004 interview with Webb. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. The U.S. government has failed to win the imprisonment of the Uhuru 3. Pacifica's Paulina Vasilia reports.
The Uhuru 3 are African People's Socialist Party Chairman Omali Yeshitela, African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess, and Uhuru Solidarity Movement Chair Jesse Neville. In September, they were found not guilty of acting as unregistered Russian agents. In a contradictory verdict, they were found guilty of conspiring to act as Russian agents. They are appealing the conspiracy conviction. On December 16th, the Uhuru 3 were sentenced to 3 years probation and 300 hours of community service on the conspiracy conviction. They had faced a maximum possible sentence of 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine each. Omali Yeshitela spoke to Margaret Kimberly, host of Black Agenda Radio.
Because the government had intended to put me in prison for 15 years, me, Penny Hess, and Jesse Neville. Their objective was to lock us up for 15 years and to fine us, to make me pay reparations of $250,000, $250,000 from each of us to pay to the United States government. That was their intent. And we beat them back. We beat them on the whole charge of being Russian agents. We were able to present to the jury our own evidence and the evidence that was provided by the prosecution of videos and speeches that we've made. And we were able to put forth pamphlets going back into the 1970s saying this is what we stand for. We've always stood for this, and take that to the jury. The jury was able to see me in Moscow and hear what I was saying when I was in Moscow. And we had a situation where we had a lawyer who stood up in the courtroom and said, Uhuru, 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 said, you're going to hear this throughout this trial. Uhuru means freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of assembly. They had a lawyer who said, Omali Yeshitela can't be bought. He's a revolutionary. He's a man of principle and whatever. You had lawyers who took those kinds of principles and took it to the courtroom itself. And the jury was able to hear this despite the machinations of the state that actually kicked off the only African woman who was on the jury, kicked her off. And we still were able to convince that jury through what they saw. The government brought 14 witnesses against us, 12 of whom were FBI agents and 2 were paid persons who they called experts, Russian experts and what have you. And the jury said, no, we were not Russian agents. We worked for Black people. And the whole thing was confusing. That's one of the reasons I was talking to you about this whole issue of the control and direction of a foreign power without registration, because the jury was confused by the prosecution on that issue, because the prosecution has the last word in terms of closing arguments. But the judge himself even though, you know, right now what the judge has done is, as you mentioned, sentenced us to 36 months of probation, something like 3 years of community service. And the judge was saying that's what you do anyway. And the judge was saying, I'm not going to fine you anything because you just raised the money for it anyway. This is what the judge is saying, because, you know, they are aware of who we are, what it is we stand for, what we do, what we've always done. And they fail in their intent to put us in prison. This was no play thing. Their objective was to put me, I was supposed to die in prison. And we were supposed to pay $250,000 each to them. But we built a movement, and it's a growing movement. It's not something that's gone away. We're going to fight that that law around conspiracy and that law around foreign agents registration. We're going to fight that. We're pulling together, even as we have this discussion now, a massive anti-colonial human rights organization. So, you know, this is how we're moving forward with this. And I think one thing we had a tremendous responsibility to do was not to crawl, to help people have confidence in our ability to fight and to win. And the only reason, by the way, that I am not in prison, that Penny Hess is not in prison, that Jesse Neville is not in prison, that we didn't have to pay those fines, the only reason is because we fought. Because what happens typically when you have the weight of the federal government move on you like that, what people have done is sell for any kind of plea deal. It doesn't matter whether they've done it or not. The government likes to brag about how the FBI has a 90-some-odd percentage conviction rate. Yeah, they do, because they have armies and things like that that terrorize people. And they are told that if you don't pay, take this deal, then you're going to get life in prison. You're going to get all this time. So we say, fight, fight. And we fought. And that's the only reason that we are not in prison. That's the only reason why the judge was able to say that this is a case that revolves around free speech, that they didn't commit any violence. They didn't do these other things. And if there's a problem, he said, the problem is that they didn't register as foreign agents. But then he said, I'm troubled by the fact, this is the judge, that the law did not require them to know they had a responsibility to register as foreign agents. And the jury didn't have an opportunity to rule on that, et cetera. This discussion wouldn't be happening if we hadn't fought.
You know, it's interesting, this Foreign Agent Registration Act. One of the biggest foreign agents, in my opinion, and the opinion of just about everyone, is AIPAC, American Israel Political Action Committee. Very powerful group. They decide who runs for office, who wins, who gets to stay in office, all on behalf of Israel. And yet they're not registered as a foreign agent. And that tells us a lot about the nature of this law, doesn't it?
It does. They're not registered, and they're not even required to register. You know, you talk about how people are assaulted, and how many people who, because of their opposition to the murder that this government is facilitating in Israel, Gaza in particular, specifically, not only Gaza, but you look at that brutality, that murder and what have you, and it's being facilitated by U.S. dollars. And with the work being done by AIPAC, AIPAC's funding it, funding people who are running for office for that. And then the U.S. government on college campuses throughout this country, intimidating people, arresting people for even talking about, and up, not just in this country. I mean, we've seen, for example, in London, I think there were three people, two of whom were Palestinians and the other not, who simply had on, during a protest, had on jackets from the river to the sea, and were arrested and faced terrorism charges. So this is really a very significant thing. So there are groups of people, there are corporations in this country who don't register as foreign agents. They spend thousands and millions of dollars in working for governments, other governments, to carry out their programs. It's very convenient the way they utilize this.
Yes, it is. And people in this country love to talk about freedom of speech, but you find out how free your speech is depending upon what you advocate for and for what you condemn. And so you and your co-defendants and others are convicted of essentially using your free speech rights, or alleged rights. I guess that's just one example of rights that we allegedly have in this country, but we really don't.
Exactly. I think, but something is happening. I mean, I don't know how the people who are working for the government are interpreting this, but really important developments. I mean, I was just looking at a poll. I think the New York Times did something with this poll, and perhaps another other ruling class media outlets that talks about how the majority of the people, how the whole judicial system is in a state of disrepute among the majority of the people in this country, that people no longer believe in the judicial system, huge sectors of that. And so every time it does something like what it's done to us and what it's doing to other people, it enhances the its opposition to the system itself. I just think that's extraordinary. And part of the political climate that we're looking at, that climate that not only elected Donald Trump, but exposed the growing influence, the lack of influence among the African petty bourgeoisie, among ruling class media here, how despite everything they did, they could not affect the election of Kamala Harris, how growing numbers of African people of leaving the Democratic Party, at least for this election that we just come through. So there's something that's afoot here that allows for somebody to apparently assassinate the person who heads this major insurance corporation and what have you, and so-called healthcare corporation, and people are cheering him on. There's something that's afoot here. There's a lot of stuff that shows how the system itself is tottering, and there's increasingly no center holding it together ideologically. Important era, important period that we live in.
Although, we have to say nature abhors a vacuum. If the media have no legitimacy and the political parties lack legitimacy, things can go in various directions. What do you think this could mean?
Things are going in various directions, and I think what it means is that we have an extraordinary opportunity here to become that alternative that many of the people are looking for. It's really interesting because you have so much increasing disregard for the system itself. It makes itself manifest a thousand different ways. Even if you look at January 6 and a thousand different ways that it makes itself manifest, but people are not united in any understanding of what that means and how we can collectively come against the system and take advantage of it, become the alternative. Because one of the things that people have been trapped with is that there appears not to be an alternative to many, many, many people to the Democratic or Republican Party. And I think that's one of the reasons they attacked us, because we're not just a protesting and opposing them, but we're actually constructing an alternative. And for us to, build, like 53 economic development projects independent of this, of the government, independent of the major corporations, et cetera. And I think those institutions that we've created and continue to create makes it it really exposes the fact that if we can do it with a tiny amount of resources we have access to, then why doesn't the government do it? I think the government cannot do it, and does not intend to do it. And so when we show that there's an alternative, you don't have to just do this, then they attack us. Now, a point I would make is that this is a splendid opportunity for us if we take the responsibility for self-determining, for governing. If we take the responsibility to go to the people and become that alternative ourselves. And even if we don't consider ourselves as individual organizations capable of doing that, deposit ourselves as part of a collective alternative. It's something that happened in the 1960s. There were 1,000 different organizations in the 1960s, obviously some more prominent than others. But what we had was a movement that presumed a responsibility to replace the system itself and not just to try to find a way inside the system. And I think that's where we are now. We have that capacity. We've seen the ruling class media incapable of driving things. We've seen the collapse, near collapse of some of the major institutions, the destruction of the or near destruction of the Atlanticist bloc of the ruling class colonial entities that's governed the world for the last 75 years. The emergence of contending forces like China and Russia, and increasingly forces like Iran and et cetera, so that the system is not tethered to the kind of hegemonic power that the United States has provided, has been in the recent past. It's unraveling. And so the point is whether or not we find ourselves just continuously attempting to become part of the Democratic Party, knocking on doors to become a part of it, providing ourselves as an alternative. And I think that's possible. That's what we do.
That was Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, speaking to Margaret Kimberly, host of Black Agenda Radio. To hear their full conversation, go to blackagendareport.com. For more information on the Uhuru 3, visit handsoffuhuru.org. For Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, I'm Paulina Vasilyev.
The system is a fraud. I said the system is a graveyard. And if you walk downtown at night, you feel for fuss and fight. And if you walk uptown, the people them frown. The system is a fraud. Them reach half a tree, them start to fret already. What a day when the pendulum swing, what a day when the well run dry, and the children ask you why, and the pit and the meat and we all living it, and the game is the same, and who is to blame? The system is a fraud, and you listen the news and you get confused, and you watch TV, it's the same thing. What a day when the pendulum swing. What a day when the well run dry. And the children ask you why. And the people them are.
This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Next, Gloria Rubeck of the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement shares a report.
Okay, right now with the death penalty, both in Texas and the United States, things are really at a turning point. Executions are down from the high of back in 98 or 99. So they're consistently going down. Public support is way down. It's the lowest it's been since the 1970s. And death sentences are down. So that means that juries are not sentencing people to death like they used to. This is because of three cases that have gotten a lot of publicity, from the Los Angeles Times to the New York Times, from the Wall Street Journal to the Washington Post to the Dallas Morning News. These cases are Robert Roberson and Melissa Lucio, who are both here in Texas, and Marcellus Williams, who was a case in Missouri. But when you have cases like Melissa Lucio and Williams in Missouri, where the judge, the DA, the defense attorneys, everybody's saying, stop these executions, the person is likely innocent, that is something that's rarely seen. In the case of Robert Roberson, his execution that was set for October was halted at the last minute due to some really creative maneuvers by people on the Texas House Criminal Jurisprudence Committee. And they subpoenaed Robert to speak at the state capitol before their committee about crime evidence and false evidence and faulty, supposedly scientific evidence. So these cases have really put us at a juncture where activity needs to be increased and publicity needs to be even more increased. And I think the death penalty abolitionists really have our work cut out for us. One of the issues of the death penalty that I believe is primary is the issue of racism. And I think that this issue cannot be separated from the death penalty. Just like when you pour a packet of Kool-Aid into water, you can never get those little granules back. When you talk about the death penalty, there's no way that you can get racism out of it under our current system. And this has been going on since the time of slavery, actually. And I'll give you a case in point. During slavery, there were 60 capital crimes that Black people could be executed for, and there was just one for white people. And then after the Civil War, lynchings increased and continued up until the early 1900s. And then instead of lynchings, they became legal lynchings, and the death penalty started being used. During the early 1900s, the first half of the 1900s, 75% of the people executed were from the South, and a vast majority were African American. And it continues to this day that Black defendants really receive very little due process. I remember working on Clarence Brownlee's case, who was an innocent man on death row, that we actually finally did get off. But we found that the Dallas County Prosecutor's Manual called Black on Black murder misdemeanor murder. In other words, they didn't really care if Black people were killing Black people. But the majority of people sent to death row are sent for killing white people. There are so many facts that deal with racism and the death penalty that it's really unbelievable. And also there's the question of innocence. And that's the issue that actually has won over more hearts and minds to opposing the death penalty than the issue of racism. Because for every 8 executions that are carried out in the United States, one person is found innocent. And that's just not a good batting average. The cases of innocence hit a little over 200 this year. And one of the last people executed was actually a man from Texas, Kerry Max Cook, who after getting sentenced to death twice and then accepting an uncontested plea of guilty because he didn't want to go on trial again, it took him 47 years to prove he was innocent. And that just happened this summer. And he was on death row in the early 80s. So the questions of innocence are actually heartbreaking. And there's a new book out by John Grisham and the man from Centurion Ministries about the cases of innocent people on death row. Clarence Brownlee's case is in that book, as is Kerry Max Cook's. But it's a really important book. Going back to the case of Robert Roberson, not only was there faulty scientific evidence, not only was there poor legal defense, but Robert is autistic. And when he's accused of killing his little girl who was 2 years old, when he took her to the hospital because he didn't act normal and didn't act like he was grieving, they decided he was guilty. And that was a lack of understanding of his autism. So his case brings out so many issues that we really need to look at when we're looking at the death penalty. We're hoping Melissa Lucio will be home soon, and that should be happening sometime in the next few months. This is Gloria Ruback with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. You can find, we're a very active group. You can find us on Facebook at The Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. Join us, get involved, and no matter where you are, do what you can to end the death penalty. This is Gloria Ruback in Houston for Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, speaking for The Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement.
Oh, death have mercy. Oh, death have mercy. Oh, death, just spare me over another year. If I was a flower in my blooms and make death cut me down so soon. Oh, death have mercy. Oh, death be them. Oh, death, just pass me over another year. What is this that I can't see with cold icy hands all over me? Stretch my eyes and stretch my limbs. This is the way that death began. Oh, death, have mercy. Oh, death, be them. Oh, death, just spare me over another year. Oh, death, have mercy. Oh, death, be them. Oh, death, just spare me over another year.
That was music by Vera Hall, Death Have Mercy, produced by Alan Momax. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Historian Russ Ballant joined Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer to discuss the right-wing billionaires driving President-elect Donald Trump's agenda to privatize public services, education, and healthcare, alongside planned crackdowns on immigrants and leftist movements. Their conversation begins with the controversial book On Humans, The Secret History of Communist Revolutions and How to Crush Them.
The book On Humans, a pretty eerie title, is put together by two writers that argue that, not argue, they assert that the people who advocate for equality and fairness in society are unhumans and need to be crushed. That's how I can summarize it in one sentence. And that's what the entire 270 pages of the book is about. And they say, this is not unprecedented. What we're advocating is not unprecedented. And the first person they put as their historic hero is Francisco Franco. And, you know, what they admire about him is that he overthrew the elected government, which was the secular government, and basically murdered all their supporters. And as you know, it started the Spanish Civil War. And then for decades thereafter, there was a very authoritarian, murderous dictatorship. In alliance with Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, Franco won the Civil War. And the famous painting Guernica by Picasso was about the Germans bombing in Spain in World War II, the city of Guernica, aerial bombardment, which was almost unprecedented at that time. So this book is endorsed by J.D. Vance, the incoming vice president, as far as we know, and by Donald Trump Jr., and by Steve Bannon, who, of course, has been Trump's kind of chief strategist, whatever title you want to give him, an open embracer of white supremacy. And Bannon actually co-published the book. His imprint was along with the main publisher, his imprint is on there, and he writes the foreword for the book. And, you know, in addition to this citation of Franco, they cite Augusto Pinochet, who, as you know, overthrew the Chilean government, elected government in 1973 of Salvador Allende, and began systematic murder and elimination of the base that put Allende in power. And that endured until 1990. And they cite that as, you know, just a masterful, another example of how you crush unhumans. One of the key writer that I focus on, Jack Prosiviak, if I'm pronouncing his name rightly, is identified by the Southern Poverty Law Center with a long list of associations with white supremacy and neo-Nazis. So that's what we have. So let's go back. J.D. Vance is endorsing this book, and Donald Trump Jr., also Michael Flynn, who was the evangelical lieutenant general of the Defense Intelligence Agency that was in Trump's first term, and then Steve Bannon, of course. Tucker Carlson, too, for what it's worth.
And what is Project 2025's relationship with this fascist program, theocratic program?
Well, there's yet another book that was just published. It's called March to Violence, Toward Violence, March Toward Violence. And it's calling for a campaign of massive suppression of political rights for any group that they deem terrorist. And of course, the people they deem terrorists are anybody who disagrees with them. They list 150 organizations, the Black Lives Matter in Detroit. They specify the Detroit chapter, Democratic Socialists of America, and many groups around fighting for Palestinian rights, critical of the genocide that's currently, you know, been visited upon the Palestinian people. And they call for a whole range of state measures. Measures by the mega state, if you will, to suppress these groups and drive them out of existence and, you know, imprison people. So it's another edition following Unhumans, which just came out in July. So these people are doing this as part of creating a body of rationalizations for what Trump is planning to do. I'm trying to remember how the links to Project 2025, but I believe there's an overlap of writers and authorities with that Capital Research Center and the Heritage Foundation.
And of course, Project 2025 says that they want to destroy public education.
Yes.
They want to privatize all public services, all the public services in the United States.
Yes.
Turn over to private contractors.
Yes. And by the way, Prosiek, one of the authors of Unhumans, I think it's fair to say that Unhumans is going to be the Mein Kampf for the Trump world. That writer works for Elon Musk.
One of the targets has been universities. And Trump, of course, threatened to round up protesters, Palestinian Americans, Palestinians, activists who are opposing the genocide in Gaza. What is their view towards education and university systems?
Well, in Unhumans, they advocate that all state public universities, all tax money of the universities since their creation has to be refunded to the people, which means it puts them all out of business. So all education is private. You get rid of all the public universities, most of your colleges of education disappear as well, because you don't need those. All you need is doctrinaires, you know, from the Reconstructionist movement and other theocratic-minded forces to create the curriculum to indoctrinate the generation of children that would follow.
And one of the plans that Trump administration has said and his supporters is to get rid of 50,000 public service workers.
Yes.
And to take them out of the merit system and to replace them with people like from Turning Point USA. What is that agenda and what does that mean for people in the United States?
Well, it means that when you have a privatized forces providing any services, they're under the guidance of the owners of the corporations. And the owners, in turn, see their sole mission as serving the profit margins of the investors. And, you know, under capitalist systems, whether no matter what scale you're talking about, the legal obligation of the corporation is to the investors, not to the public they, quote, serve or sell to or provide services to. Those are incidental, as you well know. And so the privatizing it basically means that the investor world, whatever you want to call it, Wall Street, the Chicago Exchange, whatever, will own the services and exploit the assets, which will no longer be used to for the benefit of the people. Like the private prison complex is a perfect example.
And one of the bills that just passed the House, House Bill 9495, what is that bill and what would it mean to nonprofit organizations in the United States?
Yes. Yes. H.R. 9495 is a bill that would give the Secretary of the Treasury the power to unilaterally strip away tax-exempt status, 501c3 status, and presumably 501c4 status, if the Secretary of Treasury, in his sole discretion, without hearings or without input from the targeted groups, in his sole discretion, because it is going to be a he, based on the current nominee, can take away if these groups are deemed pro-terrorist or anti-Semitic. And of course, anti-Semitic, it will be automatically a term applied to anybody who's critical of Israel's history and conduct in contemporary times. And then if any groups that are supporting that, or if your foundation who've given money to them, that can put you, that'll put you out of business. And again, we have this book that I just said, this March to Violence book, has already listed 150 groups that they think should be targeted under this law. Although they don't cite H.R. 9495, they are talking about doing those kinds of measures, as well as more extreme measures like incarcerating people, charging them with felonies that may or may be contrived or not, you know, legitimate at all.
And of course, Sean Fain, president of the UAW, attacked Trump as a scab, a union buster, a company man. He was the most open spokesman from labor, a spokesperson from labor, challenging Trump. Do you think he's got a target on his back?
I don't even speculate on that. I think it's a certainty. I think it's an absolute certainty.
If this agenda is put in place and already they have the court, they have control of the Congress, they have control of the executive, why would any company even worry about the NLRB? Because it seems like the people they're going to put in charge of the NLRB are going to either defund or destroy the organization. So you can't go through that governmental process to get a union election, to get arbitration.
Because they're laying a foundation for the indefinite future. You know, it's not here and now, it's forever. So, you know, when's the chance that there'll be a Supreme Court that will dispose of that, a ruling, and, you know, allow labor to organize?
That was historian Russ Belant speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. By Wayne Shorter. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. December 10th marked the 20th anniversary of the death of investigative journalist Gary Webb. Many believe that Webb was murdered because of his groundbreaking expose, Dark Alliance, which was published in the San Jose Mercury News in 1997. Webb's report uncovered and extensively documented the U.S. government's role in fueling the crack cocaine epidemic of the 1980s and 90s. According to Webb, the CIA created the epidemic in black neighborhoods in the Bay Area and Los Angeles to covertly fundraise to support the Nicaraguan Contras and the revolutionary Sandinistas in Nicaragua. The ensuing violence and devastating crack epidemic were later used to justify the mass incarceration of black and brown communities, feeding the U.S. prison industrial complex. Next, we share excerpts from Donald Lacey's 2004 interview with Webb. It was recorded at downtown Oakland's Jabba House months before Webb's death. This week, we'll air part two.
I always wondered what happens to the drugs. Seize them, because if you're complicit by at least turning the cheek and letting the drugs come in, seems to me once you do have these public seizures to get the perception, oh, we're out here busting drugs, it's safe to assume that they probably put them back in circulation. Because I even remember some of those old marijuana burning videos. It seemed, if I remember, the guys had on platforms and bell bottoms, the guys were, so I'm like, hey, this is supposedly 89 and these guys were wearing 70s clothes. So a so-called seizure that happened 2 days ago. So, I mean, is that too ridiculous to suggest they seize them, they put them back in circulation?
It's not actually too ridiculous to suggest. It's actually been proven that it happened. There was a very famous case in Cleveland a few years back involving a guy named Arthur Fechner, who was working for the Cleveland Police Department as an informant. And they were taking seized drugs and giving them to Fechner, and he was going out and selling them. And the ostensible purpose of this was to catch other drug dealers. They never seemed to have much success in catching other drug dealers, but they had a lot of success in putting these drugs back on the street.
Right.
Now, the other case that I want to mention involved a Venezuelan army general, and this happened, I think, in 90 or 91. This was another CIA operation. They had this anti-drug unit inside of Venezuela that was working with the CIA, and the ostensible purpose for this operation was to track the flow of narcotics to its ultimate buyers and users. They put 21 tons of cocaine that they had seized in Central America, put it on the streets of the United States, and then suddenly lost track of it. The DEA blew the whistle on it. 60 Minutes did a story on it. None of the CIA agents involved were fired or arrested or indicted. I mean, they were basically dealing drugs. I mean, you can't put any other nice coating on it.
Sure.
The only guy that got busted was a Venezuelan army general who the CIA told to go ahead and do this. He was the fall guy for it. But I think the CIA agents that put all these drugs on the street got a reprimand in their file, and that was about it.
And it would seem, from what you're saying, just from what I know, it seems like a very deliberate plot, if you will, by these agencies to not only put these drugs in the community, but target the African-American community, because you look at the sentencing laws vis-a-vis crack as for powder are disproportionate in terms of the years that accompany the sentence. And if you got the guys at the top, the main guys responsible who walk, and then you jail all these guys on the corner where you create this market, it seems like a very deliberate part to not only criminalize, but to jail a lot of these people and keep them there for life.
Well, I don't know if I agree with you that it's deliberate. I mean, I didn't find any evidence or any documents or anything saying, okay, we're going to do this because we want to, you know, decimate the African-American communities. They didn't care, which is just as bad.
Right,
I mean,
right.
They didn't care where this stuff went. And they didn't want to know, frankly. They just said, sell the cocaine, give us the money. Now, common sense would tell you that you're not going to get crack dealers winding up in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, or in Shaker
right.
Heights, or in, you know, Pacific Heights. You're going to get them in the poorer neighborhoods.
Right.
And what happened in this case was the guy that these Contras picked to market their cocaine lived in South Central, and they had a ready-made distribution system there because he was hooked up with the Crips, and the Crips were already selling marijuana. They were already selling PCP. And they knew how to get it on the streets. And the Nicaraguans, all they cared about was selling it and getting the money.
Right.
And they found an area that had very little police protection. They found an area with wide open drug markets. And they found an area that had never been experienced to crack or cocaine at all. because it was too expensive. A lot of people read my story to say the CIA invented crack to put it down in South Central and wipe out black Americans. I don't buy that. What I do know is that by 1985, they knew what was happening. They knew where this stuff was going, and they didn't do anything about it. And to me, and not just to me, but under the criminal conspiracy laws of this country, they're just as guilty as the guys that were standing on the street corner selling it. I mean, that's a fact.
Which brings me to my next question. What we as the public can do. I mean, you've provided this information, you've provided the documentation that proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that the CIA and the federal government were basically dealing drugs. And subsequently, the devastation, particularly in African-American communities where we have these burgeoning murder rates due to these drug wars. And it seems that they're very culpable and responsible for this. I know that there was one class action suit brought up by an attorney here in Oakland against the CIA that was subsequently dropped, and we tried to contact them to find out what the reasons were. But is there any recourse that the community can take to hold the government accountable for this years and years, and you can't even put a dollar figure on the devastation in human lives that this epidemic has caused?
I would say no. I hate to be pessimistic about it, but... You know, one of the reasons this story got shut down was because the African-American community got upset about it, and they were marching about it, and they were holding candlelight vigils, and they were demanding congressional hearings, and that scared the shit out of a lot of people in Washington. You know, never before had such an outpouring of anger come from the African-American community since the 60s. And there was a hearing once that they had scheduled by the Senate Intelligence Committee, and it was televised, and... You know, I've covered government for a long time, and I know that when committee hearings happen, the only people sitting in the audience are lobbyists and
right,
staff.
Right.
There were actual citizens in this.
This is the Maxine Waters?
No, this was a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing right after my series came out.
Okay.
They said, okay, we're going to get to the bottom of this. They had a hearing, and they didn't have enough seats for the people that wanted to come in to watch this thing. And when these senators said, well, you know, I think we're going to let the CIA investigate this, people in the audience jumped up and started screaming and yelling at these guys, what are you idiots? You're going to let the CIA investigate themselves? This is crap. This is whitewash. This is not what we came here for. And they started gaveling them down and threatening to throw them out of the room. I mean, here were citizens finally participating in government. And that's
right.
The last thing these guys wanted
exactly.
was actual citizen input.
True democracy.
Yeah. And so they never held another hearing after that. What they did do was they allowed the CIA to investigate itself. They allowed the CIA to release two reports, none of which have ever been fully declassified.
And is that part of where they originally scapegoated Ollie North and then kind of let him off the hook?
Well, this was, they scapegoated the Nicaraguans because, you know, they're expendable. I mean,
yeah.
They were always expendable. And they said the CIA didn't know anything about it. Well, that was an absolute lie. And they were allowed to get away with it because this report, the first report they did was 600 pages long. What was released to the public was 300 pages long. So half of that report is still classified. Now, I have to ask myself, this stuff happened in the 1980s. This is ancient history at this point in time. What is still secret?
Sure.
About this stuff. What is so classified about this stuff that we can't know about it 20 or 30 years later? And I think the answer is that the CIA knew very well what was going on. And I think the answer is that the CIA had agents that were working with this drug ring. And unless we get those classified sections of this report, we're never going to know the truth. And frankly, you know, neither political party wants this to be an issue because the Democrats are just as culpable as the Republicans in this thing. I mean, it happened during a Republican administration.
Right.
But it was a Democratic Congress.
Exactly.
And they didn't do anything about it. John Kerry, to his credit, was the only one who gave a damn about this issue. And nobody would touch it. The Iran-Contra Committee wouldn't touch it. Nobody touched this issue because... You know, I had a congressman explain to me one time when nothing was going to happen with this. Because he said, this is such an explosive issue that the government could never, ever admit that it was called upon. Number one, because of liability issues. I mean, if you say to the American public, okay, yeah, we thought the war in Nicaragua was more important than South Central L.A., and that's why we let the drugs go into the community, what's going to happen? And what do they do? Number two... what does it say about the war on drugs when the government is involved in letting some of this stuff happen? It undermines their entire moral authority. How do you lock people up for selling drugs when
that
some people
supply.
That you supply, right. Number one, and number two, that some people had a free pass to distribute? So it opens up a whole lot of things that have no easy answers, and therefore it's a lot easier just to shut the thing down and say, well, you know, it was just a newspaper story, it was an exaggeration, and, you know, just go away, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain, just everybody live their happy lives and watch your reality TV.
And I'm going to get to what this is, how it affected you personally once this hit, because I know there was a lot of backlash. But now what about the Maxine Waters hearings? In fact, I was in L.A. and I attended. She had a series of community hearings to kind of look into, you know, to what steps they could take. And I remember hearing her say, there will be no stone left unturned until we bring the culpable parties to justice. And then, you know, the whole Clinton thing kind of went down and a whole lot of other things, and it kind of got swept under the rug, so to speak. What if anything palatable or something that we can use or substantive came out of those hearings to possibly, and that's one thing we plan to revisit with her, is to try to get her to reinvigorate those hearings and revisit this subject and try to get some momentum going. What do you know about that, and how effective, if at all, were those hearings?
Well, what I can tell you is this. After the stories came out in the Mercury News, which was about as mainstream newspaper as you can get, Dianne Feinstein wrote a letter to the CIA. Barbara Boxer wrote a letter to the CIA. There were like 14 or 15 congressmen from the Bay Area who signed a letter saying, we want an investigation of this. Maxine Waters got the Black Congressional Caucus together. I went to Washington and briefed them and a number of other Democratic legislators about this issue. Because it's something, frankly, that's hard to believe. You know, after all these years of propaganda about how we're cracking down on drugs, to find out that the government's involved in the drug war on the other end.
And it's so funny. I remember that was the big Nancy Reagan, just say no campaign.
Yeah, you bet. Just
meanwhile, they're
just
saying
no to unauthorized drug dealing. So, I mean, there was a very real sense in Congress that we were going to have an investigation on this. And what happened was that the government, through the CIA and through the FBI and through the DEA, went to the other newspapers and said, shut this thing down. You know, the story's wrong. It's an exaggeration. It's this. It's that. And the other newspapers went along with it. And there are a number of reasons for that, but basically the upshot was they threw enough smoke up to scare off the senators and scare off the congressmen who think, and they made this sound like just some wacky conspiracy theory. And these people got scared, and Maxine, to her credit, didn't. And she pressed for hearings, and she got the House Intelligence Committee to do hearings on it, but they were closed-door hearings.
Right.
None of them were public. And the other problem was that the guy who ran the House Intelligence Committee at the time, and still does to this day, is a fellow named Porter Goss, who I'm sure it's a giant coincidence, but he was a CIA operative for many, many years before he came to Congress.
Mm.
So I don't know how anybody could expect that a committee run by a former CIA agent was going to do a thorough investigation of the CIA on drug trafficking charges, but they didn't. They did another whitewash. So Maxine was basically left out there on her own. And, I mean, she did do a lot of good. She got the L.A. Sheriff's Department to release a lot of very incriminating records on this thing. She got this memorandum of understanding out, but she couldn't find any support from any of her colleagues to do this. And I remember going to a hearing of the House, the one open hearing the House Intelligence Committee had. Maxine got up there and said, I've read your report. It's crap. You didn't answer half the questions. And I've got a list of names here of people who were associated with this drug operation, who were working with the CIA. I want to know what you know about them. And she read them all into the public record. Nobody ever answered her. Nobody ever answered.
That was journalist Gary Webb, author of Dark Alliance, speaking to Donald Lacey of San Francisco's Radio 89.5 KPOO in 2004. To hear the full interview, visit our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Paulina Vasiliev, and myself, Akua Holt. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.